Okay, Tyler, I think we're rolling. So
cool.
Welcome to that.
Appreciate to be back here. Yeah.
We have a lot to discuss since,
to say the least. Yeah,
since our last conversation.
Yeah, the security conference is the most recent thing.
Yeah, and this. Did you listen to the speech
from Vance? Yeah.
20 minutes of torture for you.
I mean, torture. I don't know if torture is the word, but I mean, definitely a lot of like eye rolling or exasperation. But I guess I should say though, like in the abstract, like if we're talking about freedom of speech in the abstract, I do worry about that in Europe. I mean, especially you know, looking at if we're talking about Germany, how it's responding to the protest over Palestine, the war in Gaza, when Israel's doing throughout the West Bank and so on. I definitely think free speech has been infringed, instrumentalization of the word anti-Semitic and so on. But the thing is, you know, coming from Vance, that's not what he's talking about.
Yeah, it was very surprising that when he brought up like the whole attack on freedom of speech in Germany and in Europe in general, which I mean, it's not like I think about it a lot. But it was just very surprising, you know. It's like it came out of nowhere. I mean, obviously. And then, this
interesting. Not a mention of Russia.
No, he mentioned only it's like you, Russia is not an enemy. The enemy is inside you.
That's the most urgent threat.
But like what fascinates me a lot, it's like how the roles flipped. Because I don't know, dude. I remember the time before the war. Like, I mean, even before the war in Ukraine, like the war in 2014 when
it began.
Of Crimea, I mean, Europe was actually in the position of the US right now. It was always like try to reach to the US and say, you know, kind of the same thing like the US says right now. It's like, it's so surprising how the roles reversed and like, you know, and now.
In terms of you mean being more conciliatory towards Russia?
Yeah, more kind of like realist, but being more strategically, you know, like with the kind of understanding of like a strategy, you know, you cannot really antagonize like the Russia is a country. And then, of course, now it's all the opposite, right? But of course, then to me, from European perspective, I don't know. I feel Europe, you know, as a kind of strategic project, it's like strategic thinking, they just failed.
One of the first things I see, from my opinion, is it's a lack of cohesion. You know, I don't know if you saw the Macron had a meeting in Paris immediately after the security conference. Yeah, and I mean, what I was reading was that Britain's down to send troops to Ukraine as a peacekeeping force, but then Germany says it's inappropriate at this time.
Yeah,
you know, like there's not enough cohesion for them to take decisive action. At least at the moment, that's not how it seems. Because I mean, specifically, Vance going on about free speech being under threat was surprising. But the fact that you know they were going to talk about, hey, Europe needs to take on more responsibility for their own security, that's been on the wall for years.
Yeah,
before Trump. This goes back decades.
Yeah,
you know, to the Bush administration, Bush Senior, I believe, even brought this up. Reagan. Yeah. But again, they really kind of caught with their pants down, I would say, over as a continent.
Yeah.
You know, so I think they understand that they might not be left with a choice, but then actually getting it done again.
But I don't think they have. I don't think they need to have enough power. Nor, I mean, they just don't have will, man.
That's what I'm saying. The political will, because I mean, Hungary's gonna. I mean, in terms of a European army, I saw Poland, which actually surprising. I don't know the reasoning behind it, but they were hesitant about this.
Yeah,
Poland. Of course, they have a relatively strong military, to my understanding, within Europe. But then you have Hungary as well. So I mean, in terms of like an EU military, I don't know if that's gonna happen, but
no,
I mean, they seem not to have much of a choice now.
Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of wars now. It's all about rhetoric, and to me, it was really surprising because like the moment it happened, it's like it's like fine. Of course, there was like this so much like this. I don't know, just like this empty wars coming with no support. And they still haven't done anything. It's been 2 weeks since like they can announce, like the US announced it's like, you know, like pivot to, you know, China and away from Europe.
Mm.
And Europe still has no solution. And of course, like the only solution that they came up with, you know, we kind of like try to substitute American military assistance, which is just like, but what for what cause? Like, you know, what do you want to do? It's like, do you want to just prolong the war for like another year?
I think it kind of goes back to trying to uphold what's left of the rules-based order, but then also And I mean, this is, you know, you get different opinions from different people, and I'm no military expert, so we just talking, but the idea of, will Putin stop right at Ukraine? The idea of him coming into Berlin, like, I think that's pretty ridiculous. Yeah. But the Baltics, is that ridiculous? Especially, you know, if we're going to talk about NATO, how trustworthy does Article 5 look right now?
Yeah.
If you're Putin, how confident are you that Trump would step in if he did move for the Baltics? I mean, at the moment, it almost looks more likely that he wouldn't. That the U.S. wouldn't step in. I mean, maybe I'm wrong for that, but again, with this rhetoric that you seem to get thrown around. So,
Yeah, but this is like the great Leon question, whether he wouldn't, when he has what he wanted from Ukraine, you know, if you know, they say no to NATO in Ukraine, and they kind of agree to a certain type of a deal that, you know, definitely keeps Ukraine out of NATO. It's like, I mean, the question is, why would he need to go to Baltics, you know?
Yeah, about the NATO question. But then, I mean, this is interesting, especially in the context of Zelensky saying today that he would step down from NATO, or he stepped down from leadership, if that meant Ukraine would enter NATO. Is that really enough for him? Because, I mean, they don't stay in NATO, or they don't enter NATO. But then, you know, is there going to be a peacekeeping force? I think security guarantees is, you know, a huge part. Of the equation and so on. Because, again, it really seems like he doesn't want Ukraine to be politically independent. He wants, like, a Yanukovych in. Yeah. Or I apologize. I'm no Ukraine expert. Is a Yushchenko, the one who was more pro-Russia. So,
for me, my hypothesis, and it's like actually, I will see how the talks, how the whole negotiation process will like unfold. My hypothesis was that, I mean, what like Putin tries to achieve like deep down in Ukraine is basically like this recognition from the US, you know, oh, you know, we are the power here. And of course it comes with the implication that, yeah, certainly they would have a veto over Ukraine's sovereignty. One can say they definitely don't want, I mean, I agree with you. They definitely don't want to see Ukraine as like a fully independent state, like in a word that, it can join NATO, something like this. But I mean, I also don't. I mean, from my perspective, what Russia really tries to probably achieve is like kind of like realign with West, but on its own terms. You know, kind of like being brought to the West, but from the position of kind of power and strength. Which I mean, we'll see during like the negotiation process, like what extent they're actually interested.
But then, I mean, where does Ukraine fit into that? Because I mean, if Ukraine is going to enter the EU, I mean, you can't have a country join the West and be friendly with the bloc, but then simultaneously wage a brutal war on them. I mean, we can't underestimate the scale of death that's happened on the Russian and Ukrainian side.
Yeah,
just killed and wounded. I mean.
Yeah.
So I don't know. As long as Putin's in power, I don't really know how Europe's going to be able to reconcile what he wants. But
yeah,
like you said, it's also the beginning of the negotiations. And I think Trump, if he doesn't want to get embarrassed.
Yeah. So, I mean. And we don't know like how it will, of course. Of course, with the Trump, there is a lot. It's kind of a lot of uncertainty because, I mean, it's definitely type of negotiation style. It has a big words and big rhetoric. But during the process, nothing can probably happen, you know, because the thing is, what's interesting to observe and to look at, it's like so now he can suggest something to Russian, right? But how Russia will respond, because, you know, Russia also advances on the front line. And I mean, of course, situation with the Russian economy is not great, but they're still kind of keeping it together, you know.
Yeah, at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting to see whether they will, you know, will be willing to actually accept any type of deal now, until the deal is maybe very maximalist from Russian perspective. But then probably, but dude, it's like the whole thing is very unexpected, obviously. And then there is, I mean, like the beginning of the negotiation process. I mean, I definitely see it as a positive development. I'm not, maybe you disagree, but you know, I mean, of course, I think it's like, it's not normal not to talk to the US. It's not normal for the US not to talk to Russia. Mm-hmm. It's pretty dangerous, you know. It's like the world, I don't think it's like anyone wants to live in. So it's kind of like a positive development. But then you have like the whole barrage of like, you know, tweets about Zelensky, and this is like, this
I mean,
is like,
it's just a lot of disinformation. I totally think it's important for them to communicate, and my understanding they have, even during Biden's last term, in terms of over certain things and avoiding escalation. There's been talks with Lavrov on occasion, so on and so forth. But these negotiations, I'm very suspicious of, because it's just almost like the eager manner that the U.S. is embracing them in. And again, it's on what terms? Again, not even acknowledging that Russia started the war.
Yeah, blaming Ukraine.
I mean, what is that? I don't know what kind of basis that is. And then,
but it's kind of, you know, Mearsheimer, right? Mearsheimer, like this dude on YouTube, like a famous professor. I mean, he kind of takes his argument, right? And he says it's not like Russia's fault. It's like he kind of takes like this realist perspective. What we said off the mic, maybe he has like this, like a team of like deep down realists, and this is kind of his new approach to foreign policy, you know.
Yeah, perhaps, but I mean, I still don't see how Russia doesn't have responsibility, because I understand encouraging the NATO, Putin feels uneasy, but the idea that the U.S. would actually, I say the U.S. because I feel like he sees Ukraine as a U.S. proxy.
Yeah.
This war is a proxy for him as a war against the West, the U.S. being the leader
of
the West. But it's like, in what climate was the U.S. going to invade Russia? I mean, right after Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it wasn't going to be Europe calling for it. Germany wanted the Russian gas, and then just no European countries in any sort of condition to fight the Russian army. So,
yeah.
I think, honestly, I do think that's paranoia on his part.
No, but it's mostly if you take the question of NATO, you know. It's like, if you think from NATO perspective, I mean, the problem is, like, I mean, probably how Russia sees the situation, it's not like short-term thinking, it's like long-term thinking. Especially if Putin is gone, they probably will, you know, push forward and just, you know, accept Ukraine into NATO. Which, you know, it was almost done. It's like they were like that close to being in NATO with like membership action plan. So, I mean, I also don't know. It's like, you know, the end game. So the end game of like previous, I mean, we can also talk a little bit, you know, how you think about like what was before Trump. I mean, in a way, it was type of like a Cold War. I mean, what Trump would say, you know, kind of deep state, right? But kind of Cold War bureaucratic apparatus that was kind of pushing this, I mean, pretty much maximalist agenda from American perspective, right?
Towards Russia?
Yeah, towards the world, I would say, right? Russia, including Russia. Kind of expand the NATO, you know, don't regard Russia as like a proper kind of powerful state and stuff like this. And kind of, like, again, and with the war in Ukraine, it came to the point of like, of a really acute problem. And Russia, you know, as a country said, you know, we have a will to kind of solve it this way.
But then again, it comes back to the rule-based order again. It's like, well, do states have their own sovereignty or not? Does Ukraine have the right to join or not? And I mean, if you're talking long-term in terms of, you know, would the U.S. invade Russia or would the NATO invade Russia in 20 or 30 or 40 years? I mean, clearly Putin saw it as a possibility, but I don't. Again, I think that's paranoid on his part.
But if you think from again perspective of just exclusion, if you just think, oh, you know, we expand NATO, I mean, NATO is kind of like, you know, like an European security architecture, but we expand it just to the border of Russia without accepting Russia, without any chance to accept Russia. I mean, this is also ridiculous a little bit. Like, why would you not consider accepting Russia to this structure? Because like you recognize that Russia is important, right? For like. Through the special, they had like the special status for Russia, right? So they still recognize that Russia is really important, but they kind of like, oh, you know, like the chances that Russia would become part of NATO were none, like zero. It's like everyone knew it's not going to happen. Yeah. So I guess it's also like a little bit hypocritical to just extend NATO to Russia, to the border of Russia without even thinking, oh, you know, let's invite Russia.
Do you think Putin was really interested in NATO membership at this point, though? I feel like he desires a certain level of autonomy from whatever the NATO policy would be as well.
I mean, in a way, but the problem is if you accept Russia to NATO, it will probably change the dynamic, you know?
It would.
Because it will be the only country that can, you know, kind of have a certain, not the only country, but especially if you can align together with Europeans, maybe. You can have like a kind of different type of, you know, security architecture, or at least you can rearrange it in a way that it's kind of more comfortable.
But then, you know, not the whole time, because not in the early 2000s, but from 2008, you also have the war in Georgia as well, and then so on. Like, I mean, it's hard to reconcile that with NATO ship, with the NATO members of existing, with the existing NATO members. I think it was an entirely totally avoidable war that he decided to pursue. I mean, because I mean, there are other leaders in his position who didn't take that path, like a Yeltsin and so on.
But they were also very weak. I guess that's also important to understand. They didn't have enough kind of military capability, and actually not enough will. I mean, obviously the whole you know, decision to invade this is a kind of course watershed moment for like everyone. But yeah, I mean, but what a gamble! Like, you know, I mean, we'll see where the whole negotiation process leads. If they make a deal on Russian terms, that's like, I mean, I discussed it off mic, and I guess on mic with you. I mean, this is just, it's like unbelievable gamble that he took, if you think about it.
Trump or?
No, Putin, like basically, you know, from perspective of to take this gamble without really any understanding of how to proceed and then.
To engage in good negotiations.
No, if he gets like a deal that kind of very favorable to Russia, which, you know, it might not happen. But if it happens, again, this is pretty big kind of success, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
but not from a human perspective, of course, you know, success from like this geopolitical perspective, not like from a human perspective, he doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. But perhaps, but then also you had Norway and Finland joining NATO, or was it Sweden? Maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah, but they never really, you know. They never really cared about this because it was never in under influence of Russia anyway. So
yeah, I do understand that Ukraine is supposed to see the position, I guess, where the border is. You know, it's particularly porous.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like a strong natural land barrier. So hypothetically, you know, if an invasion were to take place. But I guess I can understand from a certain perspective of Russian history why he was paranoid about it, but...
Yeah,
I mean, think about also how the people in Europe, and I would say the U.S., but at least in Europe, would react if a NATO war, if NATO invaded Russia for whatever reason. I mean, it would be suicidal. Well, not suicidal, perhaps, but very damaging to a country like Germany, who, I mean, the EU is the German-French alliance, you know, at its core well. So, yeah, but the sitting down for negotiations, like you said, it's early. We'll see, but... I do think Trump, and he likes Putin. I think he envies his power, or the perceived power that he thinks Putin has. I think he totally holds like checks and balances and a constitution in contempt. So I think that's part of the appeal that he has. And then Zelensky clearly doesn't like, for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, just because I think he's not agreeable. And it's also interesting how, you know, it's... in American foreign policy toolbox, just like to advocate for basically regime change, right? If something doesn't go like in, if something doesn't go in American way. But again, I like this concept that like Trump kind of like embodies like this American behavior, but in a very kind of like blatant, obvious way, because it was always kind of there. It's like, if we don't like the like someone in power in this country, we don't want to deal with him. It's like, we're too powerful for that. We can just like, you know, knock you off. It has always been like an American, you know,
thing. Yeah, all the, you know, assassinations, coups from South America. Yeah. I mean, if we're talking about Russia, though, I don't think that was the aim of the Biden administration at all. Because I think they were afraid of what would happen.
Yeah.
Because there's no clear line of succession after Putin. So if Putin is to die tomorrow, what's going to happen to the state? Who's going to get the nukes? If we're going like the extreme scenarios and like a state collapse, like there was a certain level of instability that would bring that I think Biden was.
So I'm not sure, man. I mean, of course, ideally they would love to see him toppled by like a democratic pieces.
In a dream world, sure, but I think they understand that the probability of that is not likely at all at this moment.
I mean, well, it was likely like in 2012 when they were like a big protest.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean I can't speak on that, but in that case, the U.S. government, like, they didn't act on that. They didn't call for Putin to step down. They didn't introduce
or whatever in sanctions they introduced. I mean, they weren't designed to suffocate the state. So I think Biden, and I'd probably say agree, we're careful not to go down that route. But I mean, the thing is, if you're talking from an American perspective about Ukraine, we're talking about something that was 0.04% of our GDP. Yeah. It was like a 4, 5, or 3, less than 1%. And that, yeah, that's not including, I think that's including actually loans and then whatever, you know, U.S. defense companies are shipping stuff out over there. So, I mean, for us, it was really a small allocation of resources.
Yeah.
And if we're looking from the American perspective, I think it was a great bang for the buck. You're weakening a strategic rival, or a perceived one, so to say, but I say they are one, for something that was a small, I mean, in a way, maybe even a benefit. I don't know. I don't have all the economic numbers on hand of how much money they're bringing in. But
it's like, yeah, I guess it comes to, it's just like, you know, war is just like a game of wheels, you know. It's like the Russia just has a kind of a bolder, like, will.
Yeah, well, I think there's a connection. I do agree with the argument. There's a connection between democratic decline at home and this attitude towards Putin. I think in terms of acting decisively, there's a decline, democratic decline. We struggle to come to consensus and have an overarching strategy. And then you have a dude, I mean, Trump, he wants to be authoritarian. The only thing stopping him is our institutions.
Yeah.
I mean, because and this is one of the irresponsible aspects of Vance's speech at the Munich conference. Yeah. He's lecturing Europe about democracy.
Yeah.
As the vice president of a dude who tried to overthrow an election he lost.
Yeah. Do you think he has, like, this appeal to masses? Like, you know, because, like, every
Trump?
Yeah.
It's like I think, I mean, this is kind of, you know, going to a separate conversation, but I do think, you know, Trump speaks more effectively to the feelings of a lot of Americans than the Democrats do. And this is someone who voted for Kamala, and I do not agree with almost anything, most of what Trump does. I think he's a threat to democracy and so on. So I think that's kind of one of these cases. And as always, I got to shout out Vlad Voxer at some point, because he just makes a good point, is that, you know, you have some of the most irresponsible politicians addressing some of the valid concerns in our society about like lack of freedom of speech, again, in an abstract sense, you know, and so on.
I'll be honest, I have like a very kind of mixed feelings about this whole American situation, because I mean, I definitely was like Democrat leaning person, I mean, up until like maybe Biden administration, right? But something like the moment, like, I don't know, I saw the Biden and the whole, like, you know, I just, something like in me, it's just like, it was off, you know, like with the whole kind of narrative. I don't know, like a narrative plus. I don't want to say, you know, I'm pro Trump, but I'm kind of.
Like, speak your truth, Dimitri. No, speak your truth.
No, I'm not. No, that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, because I'm not American anyways. It's not, for me, it's a little bit of distant, you know, it's, I mean, I don't live in the US. I cannot really have the same connection. But what I'm trying to say is like, imagine if someone like not Trump came to power with the same type of kind of vigor, you know, to change stuff, you know, because I mean, there are a lot of problems in the US, right? And like people discussed it for at least the last 20 years. You have like a deficit, like the whole deficit problem, you know, a bunch of stuff, right?
And especially wealth inequality being one of the biggest ones for me.
Rapidly
growing wealth inequality.
And also, like, even what he suggested, like, to cut the military budget together with Russia and China, like, you know, overstretching, you know. And this is, of course, due to, like, consecutive administrations. Like, you know, and I mean, consecutive administrations, whether, like, Republicans or Democrats, they kind of, like, supported one, you can say, like, a meta-narrative about the U.S. It's like, you know, America is, like, you know, and it coincided, of course, with the time when the U.S. was the most powerful nation, right? And now it kind of came to an end. So there's definitely like a need to be for the U.S. to be something else, right? And like also to regain its own kind of appeal to the world. I mean, I would say so, because, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I see the Trump as this person who just breaks the whole system. It's like, you know, he probably breaks years of like bureaucracy and like, it's like just years of people thinking in the same direction. He just tries to bring something new. It's like, I don't know how to feel about it. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I see that. I think that's how a lot of people view it in terms of the system isn't working for us. I think they see that their wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living. A lot of issues aren't getting addressed decisively, like access to healthcare, gun violence, and so on. But again, I just think the idea that our elites aren't working for us, maybe they're even working for foreigners as well. They're just not in our interest. Goldman and Trump, Sachs. Yeah, Trump is the orange wrecking ball that's gonna wipe the slate clean. But then, and you know, it's ironic because I do consider myself someone who's leftist, but I guess maybe I'll tap into conservatism here, where it's like I do think there are some value in some of the institutions that the U.S. has. If we're talking about checks and balances, you know, an executive that can't simply do what they want, a court that checks whether something fits to the Constitution, and so on. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think the U.S. is ripe for, like, needs radical change.
Yeah.
But for me, the issues that I see is massive wealth inequality, a housing crisis. I mean, housing is I think 50% of people spend 30% of their income or more on their rent.
Yeah.
For 50% of renters. I mean, that has all these trickle-down effects, and he has no plan for that. And this is where I do think it's a problem that he wants to tear down all these institutions, is that it's to unleash the power of the executive, the executive office. And then a man like him, with his character, I don't see what this does for the quality of life of the average American. And I think they're weakening the U.S., at the end of the day. I think they're weakening our credibility because, you know what? I mean, with Biden a few months ago, was Ukraine as our ally as long as it takes or as long as we can.
Yeah, and but now, you know, what I actually tried to say, kind of my argument, I guess I have to, like, put it down maybe to have, like, you know, like a really argument about it. It's like the way the U.S. supported Ukraine during Biden, it was so fake. It was so contrary, like, classically defined American interests. That is why it's like it happened so fast that, you know, there's really no interest in America, like real no strategic interest in Ukraine. That's why it's kind of so easy to flip it, you know. Of course, he did the same in a way in Europe, but it's still not the same. Of course, like, everyone understands that the U.S. is still there. U.S. is in NATO.
I think it is in the U.S. strategic interest to keep to a rules-based order, but also to have Europe as an ally and not alienate. Jesus, Europe, because just of how wealthy Europe is, and how they can assist Europe in that matter, and then going back to, again, how small of our GDP it really costs to support Ukraine. Yeah. I think it was a win-win because, I mean, you know how it's framed. I mean, now he's just kind of, he doesn't say it as much. He just kind of goes to his transactional mindset. But, you know, in the campaign, a big, you know, the narrative that was put out was, you know, we have all these problems and we're sending billions to Ukraine. Yeah. We have all these problems and we're doing this, and that for Ukraine, when, you know, a lot of it wasn't direct cash, a lot of it was military goods, and again, how small it was. So it's like, what? I don't see what this does for us pulling out.
I
don't know. It's not a good look. And then, you know, to get buddy-buddy with somebody like Putin, and you can point out the hypocrisy of U.S. policy. You have Gaza going on as we speak, and that's just the most overt example.
And he's, of course, like pro-Israeli, right? I mean, he's...
Yeah. I mean, that's a tradition of U.S. presidents. You won't find a U.S. president... I mean, if you read behind the scenes, Biden didn't like Netanyahu. He really criticized his policy. But at the end of the day, the arms, the military supplies were flowing. And then, you know, we support El-Sisi in Egypt as well. So there's all kinds of hypocrisy. But with Ukraine,
I mean, just from my perspective, I don't know, like, where, how this war is going to end. I mean, if there continues to be, like, you know, like this consistent American support, because it will just lead to probably extended war for longer. But then you have to, you know, until, like, Russia collapses. I mean, this is one type of, like, everyone was, of course, betting on that. But, I mean, if it doesn't happen, I mean, then it's like, it's a policy that kind of just fails. Because if you don't see Russia collapsing, you know, you'll probably see some type of, like, again, Russia is just getting ground on Ukraine. And then it will end with some type of deal anyway. Like, for example, for me, from my perspective, like, dude, I mean, either Europeans or Biden should have like negotiated with Putin really like from the position of power back in the day. I mean, when, you know, like Ukraine was advancing on the front line, there was a good time to negotiate. But now, you know,
he has the momentum.
I mean, there's momentum on the Russian side. So that's why, like, and then it's interesting to see. I mean, I don't know whether Russia is going to, agree to any kind of deal that is not really favorable to it. So I don't really know.
Yeah, those questions are still to be seen. Yeah, no, I mean, you could, point out all kinds of mistakes made beforehand. Yeah. I can't say too much on that, but then again, you know, if Putin does insist on Ukraine not being politically independent, then you've kind of hit a brick wall, unless you're just kind of like, hey, okay, which Trump very well do, but time will tell. Because again, if Putin succeeds in getting Ukraine to be an unstable basket case that's dependent on Russia, just are unable to join NATO or EU or do anything that Putin doesn't approve of, then we're going back to the time of spheres of influence. That, I mean, we're going to a kind of, what does that mean? Kind of like an 1800s kind of politics.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, I don't want to get outside and talk out of my ass, so to say, but the way I see it, I mean, that's much more ripe for escalation, instability, and just more suffering for humanity than what we did have since 1945, with all its flaws. And you could say it needs to be reformed radically term.
But would you say, like, if Putin gets Ukraine, right, he gets a veto on Ukraine's future in NATO, like, would you say, I also don't kind of see this type of scenario, because, you know, I don't actually see even Putin just going and just invading countries, you know, for no good reason.
Yeah, but you very well might be right, but then also it's about what it means in general. So, I mean, the most immediate other example would be, well, China's watching this with Taiwan, but then what it just means in general in terms of, hey, if I'm strong enough, I can do what I want to such and such country near my border if I simply have the power. And again, I understand that happened even since 1945, but I would say not to the same extent in any other historical period. And again, as I said, I think that's bad for humanity, and I think it's not good for escalation between powers. So,
I
don't know what's going to come out of the process. I mean, it's just begun. And then, of course, you know, Trump wants all the money back from Ukraine. I mean, Zelensky he's having to clarify that, oh, Biden told me, you know, a certain section of this money was a grant.
At first, when I read it, I thought it's like a fake, you know. I thought it's like not real news.
It's so narrow-minded. Because the way I see it is that Trump doesn't see the bigger picture. I don't think he has any kind of international relations theory in his mind.
Until you look at this whole position of realigning with Russia against China.
Yeah, I think maybe people in his administration think that way, but on his level, before he sends out these tweets, I don't think he has a bigger picture like that. I think he sees it as a transaction that happens in a vacuum, and he's like, why am I giving all this money? Because on the sticker prices, it's a lot, billions, and why am I giving all this money, and they're not going to decisively win?
Yeah, but I feel like I mean, one shouldn't, you know, take his tweets for granted. I mean,
But you have to, because he's the president.
Yeah, but you know, it's like
his words have power.
Of course, but it's like we live in this type of information, like, kind of environment where, like, what you say, like, even what Trump said during his first presidency, we all forgot it. Like, dude, like, I mean, and one can point out like a very interesting fact, right? How they had like the whole Russian affair with Trump, and now he goes directly into Russian, like, you know, Russian policy, like, kind of like pro-Russian.
He's saying pro-Russian,
and no one even like brings it up that they had like a Russian, like, type of like Russian affair with him. Like, everyone forgot about it.
I mean, some people didn't forget. I didn't forget.
No, I know, but, you know, people don't really.
It's not talked about mainstream, but I mean, now I think.
No, it's it kind of gives you to how our brain works. We just forget. Like, we don't really take this, like, you know, seriously.
I see the point you're making, but I still think that level of position of power, your words in themselves have power. And then I think, you know, in terms of people not speaking up, I do think you're seeing a bit, you're starting to see some self-censoring now. You're starting to see people who don't like what they're seeing and really, like, and their heart is saying something, but they're scared to.
Of course,
because what's gonna happen? You know, is he going to send some BS case to me or so on and so forth? Because, I mean, he has Congress.
Yeah.
He's fired a lot of people in the military.
Yeah.
And replaced them as well.
I mean, they have like this Doge thing, right?
Yeah, Doge going through government efficiency, less government good. That's not a philosophy I inherently agree with.
Yeah.
But so that's something you have to keep in mind as well, though. And that's scary territory to be in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're also talking about the state of U.S. democracy at this point. And, of course, it was severely dysfunctional, I would say, before Trump came in. But now...
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, he's not going to be able to turn the country into a dictatorship by the end of his term. But he's weakening institutions. And I think it's ripe for someone to come in.
I mean, like from my perspective, of course, one observation... It's kind of fascinating how, because we know, I mean, of course you have American institutions, but because that's also what we study, right? You know how they change, right? And how they can actually accumulate progress, but like change in a way. Because like in any other country, man, I think like such a big change could only happen probably with a revolution. Like such a big, profound change in policymaking.
That's one way to look at it. Yeah, this is something that our professor Lambert would say, is that there's a certain range of change that can occur within the U.S. system, no matter who's considered president. And you can't go outside these certain boundaries unless some sort of severe crisis happens, like a Great Depression, which led to the New Deal, or a massive war, which is more unlikely in the case of the U.S. because of its natural geographic protection, or a crazy, protest movement, like the civil rights movement. But otherwise, it stays within these certain bounds.
Yeah.
And that's why, I'm saying this sitting in a chair right now, and it's much easier said than done, but I think we're at a point where you need some sort of mass people-based movement to get change that I would like to see.
Yeah.
Because right now, I mean, I see dudes who are just taking power, who are self-interested. I see a lot of white supremacist ideology.
Yeah.
It's a dude who's erratic. Trump is neurodivergent, for sure. I mean...
I don't know about that, man. That's
you don't think so?
I don't know what it means, though.
For example, and this is armchair psychology, but we talk and you got your own podcast and we talk, and like, I think he's a narcissist, at the very least. A narcissist, and then, I mean, the smallest, and not even insult, disagreement, he can turn into a spat, like.
But yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit fascinated by, I guess it's a little bit in Russian culture to be fascinated, like, with people who have like that amount of power. And to me, it's just like, it's just another level of human understanding. I just don't know what is going on in his head. I mean, I don't know whether it's appropriate just to kind of like, not creating an insult, but at the end of the day, I mean, he definitely has some, like, something to him that is very unique, for sure. I mean, because there's no character like this, in the world. Of course, he's a narcissist. Yeah, I mean, this is pretty...
And then maybe ADHD as well. I mean, because I don't know if you've read, but like he wasn't reading the daily briefs that he was brought to him in his first term. That's what people behind the scenes said. And of course, some might call out fake news. I believe that was Bob Woodward, who he broke the Watergate scandal with Nixon and the shit in the hotel and them trying to get those documents. I believe that was him. And if that was, I trust him. But my point is, even if it wasn't Bob Woodward, I read that. And then I see the stuff that he says, during his first term when there was a wildfire out in California and they're talking to him about it. And he said, don't worry, it'll get colder.
Yeah.
That sounds like a dude who doesn't read much. I don't think he has a grasp of really most of the basic issues. He doesn't take the time to read and educate himself. And it's not like he doesn't come from any expert background, of course.
No,
so
he's not. I mean,
I agree with the idea that he goes off these dispositions.
Yeah.
He has certain feelings that he gravitates towards, and the most influential person for him is the last person who spoke to him.
Well, now it's Elon Musk, for sure.
And Elon Musk is not a stable individual.
He's like, of course, it's a little bit surprising how, like, a literal billionaire can, get into office.
And we have a bunch. I mean, the U.S. political system is already skewed towards the rich in terms of just how expensive it is to run for office. It's already tilted towards people from a certain class to run for office. But now it's taken to even... Because you have Trump, who's a privileged person, then
Musk a billionaire. Like, these people aren't going to address, they're not interested in addressing the most urgent needs of the wider population. Again, I mean, we have a housing crisis, cost of living crisis in the country, and it's not even really part of the mainstream discourse.
Right.
It's the biggest, one of the biggest issues, it's immigration.
Yeah.
And I don't know, inflation and so on. It's, so I mean, as an American, I can definitely say, like, it's, it makes me more hesitant to go back home, for sure. Right.
Yeah, I mean, but, like, again, on the other hand, like, wouldn't you take, like, example of Trump as, like, the possibility of change in itself? Like, you know, like, something like this cannot happen neither in Russia nor in Germany, because, like, you don't have the culture that even can, you know, cultivate those people. I mean, you can only cultivate, I mean, in both cases, just, like, if it is dictator, I mean, of course, if it's like in Russia, it's a dictator from like the, like a deep bureaucracy, right? Like Putin just came from a deep bureaucracy. I mean, in Germany, I don't know, German politicians are like plain as fuck. They are very boring. But at least you have like the system. No, I'm just thinking even for the future of Democratic Party, you can cultivate type of a person, like a Democrat, in a way that, you know, kind of, well, you know what I'm trying to say? You can kind of like try to make your own Trump for Democratic Party, or like another person can make it to the top
with, yeah, like someone who's a political outsider
with a pretty ambitious and wild agenda and still, you know, can make it. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, it's
not, yeah, but but you know, who is an outsider, so to say, that can make it? Because I mean, you could also get into Trump. You know, he hung out with the Clintons, used to be friends, he was in certain elite circles, but yeah, he was never a politician, though. He was never a politician. He was a political outsider. But, you know, it's also who can come out of nowhere and jump into office like that? Because, you know, Trump's got this raggedy ass hair. He's not really educated. He's not educated about the issues and so forth. And he can come out of nowhere and win office. But, you know, if we're talking about a black dude with dreads who comes in, I don't know.
But I mean, you still have to see, like, in terms of the demographic dynamic and stuff like this. I mean, that's what I'm trying to, I mean, I'm trying to be kind of like a little bit optimistic, because you have a, like a literal kind of shift in American politics just because of the power of, you know, individual and the system. I think there is something about the system that, despite all this kind of, you know, I don't know, like bureaucracy, you know, it still allows kind of like a change.
Yeah, change. I mean, Trump can bring real change. I just think it's going to be negative for the vast majority of the population. Except for some rich people, you know. Mm-hmm. Can we take a bathroom break?
Sure. So I continue with talking about that day, you know. I mean, on the podcast, because I was still there, like, you know. Because we're recording on the...
We're going back to the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, where were we in the U.S.? I mean, no, what I'm trying
about,
to...
About how Trump shows the capacity for change in the...
Play. Yeah, I mean...
I think he is going to bring some change. I just don't think it's a change that's going to be good for the people. I mean, you can't, like... The U.S. democracy is not in a very resilient shape right now, I would say. Our institutions and are stronger than... At least they're as strong as any democracy in the world. But, I mean, they're getting... openly attacked right now. And again, it's ironic for me, but to draw on some sort of conservative thinking, but the idea that some certain traditions have value, or things that have been around for a certain period of time, you know,
like, but like, wouldn't you say that I mean, before Trump there was certain type of consensus in both the Republicans and Democrats? I mean, if we go maybe 2016, before, like, those Republicans like Bush, that this consensus was, like, eventually kind of detrimental to the future of the U.S., you know?
I absolutely agree with that. I think radical change is necessary, but just not from this far right. I've told you, there's some fascist elements in there. I don't know if you saw Steve Bannon do another...
No, of course. I mean, I don't disagree with that. I mean, what I'm trying to say, it's like... It's kind of like just the capacity for change is kind of there. I mean, it was kind of like hijacked by those forces, but just because, like, the change is there, the change is already happening. What I'm trying to say, like imagine if Trump is a wrecking ball and he demolishes, like, the old system. Well, you can go and build something new afterwards, you know, in a way.
But I think you can't underestimate how much damage he's gonna do.
before. But like, they're still going to be the same institutions. I mean, he's not going to like tear down.
Filled with MAGA people. I mean,
because the thing is, you got to also think about how
Trump, you know, came in, or how I perceive it. Because I mean, I believe there's a series of filters in terms of political life in the U.S. that prevents someone from a certain class and background from reaching the highest office from president. In terms of class boundaries, first and foremost, and then there's racial ones as well. Because, I mean, with Trump, he was saying overtly, like, you have to connect him to the rhetoric that Republicans have been saying for a long time in terms of, you know, the idea that some of the poor are deserving and some aren't. The idea that there's welfare queens, people who abuse the welfare system. Ronald Reagan was big on this in the 80s. And there's always the image of a black woman who abused the welfare system. And, I mean, the Southern strategy from Richard Nixon, you know. Mm-hmm. We're going to speak to the racial anxiety of the South in the context of the Civil Rights Movement, Civil Rights Act, and so on. And we're going to use coded language to speak to them. So, like, states' rights, law and order. And that's so influential. You can see, I saw Marcus Zuda from the CSU party, you say it in English. And I see it on CDU placards in German.
Yeah.
Rest in Ordnung.
Yeah.
It's law and order, and that's coded language. Because on the surface of, you know, depending on your beliefs, you say, well, what's wrong with some order? I mean, we don't want chaos and people killing with each other. But an order based on what?
Yeah.
You know, these were coded languages used to appeal to white people who were uneasy about gains in racial inequality and so on. And Trump said a lot of the quiet parts out loud in terms of, you know, they're bringing the rapists and their worst, you know, the immigrants and so on. And then, you know, he was at that event for black journalists and he was like, you know, immigrants are taking black jobs. Yeah. But, you know, what is a black job? And one of the interviewers asked him that and he's like, oh, well, it's, you know, a black person who has a job. But it's, you know, it's, you have to understand the form of change that Trump comes into. Part of his appeal is appealing on racial fears. Otherwise, though, I do agree he's speaking to some problems that people really have with the status quo, with the neoliberal system that we live in and so on. But
yeah,
leads to another interesting question is like, can the system reform itself in the U.S.?
I mean, what Trump is doing, I mean, he kind of hijacked, well, he's probably trying to destroy the old system, right? But he can build some, because the institutions are going to be there. I mean, he cannot, like, get rid of, like, Senate or Supreme Court
But then it's like, how do you view the people around him? Because, bro, like, and again, this does go back at least partly to his, my opinion, he is neurodiverse, is like, what, I don't think he's capable of having a grand political ideology. I don't think he has. I don't think he sees a plan like, okay, you know, 2035 we'll have this alliance and so on, and I'm going to build this domestically. I'm going to build this coalition and appeal to this people, this certain group, and so on. I don't see him as a very savvy political operator.
Yeah, he's kind of like a political animal. No, because also, I mean, it's. Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't have that type of knowledge, and I don't know who actually has this type of knowledge, like, to talk about those, like, people. I mean, probably people who work with him closely can kind of give you insight into his thinking. I don't know. It actually, like, reminds me a lot, like, people talk about, like Trump, how people talk about Putin, because in Russia we call it Putinology. You know, it's like this, like, because, like, every decision is made by Putin, and it's like, and people just write books about how Putin thinks, but they don't know shit about how he thinks. I mean, you can't go to his brain. I mean, it's like, it's impossible. So, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't really kind of, like, focus that much on this, the fact that how he does it. But it's just, like, for me, it's, I mean, I think one has to go and look closer at what happened in 2020. Because that, I mean, is a big change, right? I mean, think about it. I mean, he actually comes now in full force with the same agenda he had in 2016, right? But there's some full force now, right? He doesn't try. I mean, probably
he's got more loyalists around him as opposed to the first term.
And he probably didn't know how it's going to look like, because he never worked anyone in politics, right? He didn't know how to operate the system. Now he has an insight, has probably
team. He has experience.
Experience, right? He does it completely differently. What I'm trying to say, and still people in 2020, you know, he didn't win. And I'm trying to say, it's like, if you just bring some, at least some, I mean, I don't even want to say to bring, but if you have some type of a democratic backlash that is appealing to some type of people that Trump took in 2024, you can have a good chance of just like turning like, you know, tables around. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, it's not kind of completely gone. It's just that it's still a wild American kind of competitive
game.
You're
talking about like Trump is a catalyst for change. It's more positive.
No, I'm just trying to say.
Indirectly?
Trump is just a catalyst for change, right? But then you can change it, like, go into other direction. Of course, if you don't...
Yeah, so, like, hypothetically, like let's say, like, from a progressive liberal or whatever.
Yeah, because...
Oh, people will get really pissed off about him. He'll get obliterated in the midterms, then he'll get obliterated in 2028, and we'll have someone who does real change.
In a way, right. Because, I mean, Democrats will have to come up with a person... Of course, he will not run the third time, of course.
I can fathom it. Because, I mean, this is something I've heard in different words from people back home.
Yeah.
That, you know, oh, though he'll wake the Democrats back up. But I think when you say that, I think, one, you're underestimating how much damage he's going to do because he's putting loyalists in. Like, I don't know if you've read up on these guys, Pete Hegseth, Cash Patel. Yeah. It's a... Generally, I
feel like those are senior positions.
Yeah, but even, you know, this is why I brought up the loyalty test last time we saw each other off a podcast in terms of, you know, what happened on January 6th. The way I see it, it's a lot of people who are unqualified but are there because they're loyal to him. And it's, you know, even though there are some certain people of color in there, you also have a lot of people who have white supremacist ideals. And what I'm saying is that it's these people could hold on to power or mess with the rule of law, which is a concept I deeply believe in, going forward. But then the other thing is, in terms of viewing it as, oh, he'll wake the Democrats up, is I think you're neglecting the structural constraints that make it so that you have these same kind of people who support the status quo and the rich staying rich and so on in power. Again, how expensive it is to run for office. Yeah. The fact that states with a lower population have disproportionate power in the U.S. system. You know, every state gets two senators, no matter the population. And then you have the filibuster as well, which... In practice, recently in the recent past, has now become a huge factor that you always have to take into account. You need a supermajority. So, you know, it's the system itself that I think contributes to a lot of the stagnation. And because, you know, it's one thing some of my friends said to me, and it was interesting to think about. He's like, and you can agree or disagree, but again, I think it's something to think about. He's like, you know, a Martin Luther King nowadays is a Barack Obama. And what I interpret him to mean by that is you have someone who is extremely intelligent, extremely well-spoken. Mm-hmm. I think Obama did understands how racist American society is. I think he very well understands that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the constraints that we have in the system, if you look at Obama's term in terms of legislation passed, concrete changes, not just rhetoric, but concrete changes, not a whole lot changed. You had the procedural review programs that he instituted for certain police departments. He had the federal government come in, the Justice Department, and review their policies. Mm-hmm. And structural, systematic racism and abuse was found in the few that he did. St. Louis was one. I forget. Baltimore. But again, there was no structural change.
I agree with you. But like, would you say, I mean, because like, I don't know how it started. And I'm not that big of an expert on like American party system and, you know, what they have, what is going on inside the party when they choose like and elect like the candidates. But again, if you go to Trump winning 2016 primaries, like in a vote, right, in a kind of democratic vote inside his party, what if you do the same with Democrats? Because I think like what the problem with Democrats is that it turned into like ultimate party machine that doesn't really care about like even personalities.
And they're also out of touch with people. They are out of touch.
Yeah, I mean we will see in primaries, that's a big for America, it's always like after 2 years, that's a big, you know, kind of like a check on the power of like a sitting president, whether they're gonna like choose at least one house is going to turn back democratic. I don't know. But again, it's just I see it as a kind of like a positive change for Democrats for the future, because you have to do something to change things in democratic system. Because like, dude, like Republicans changed a lot. Like, right, they're unrecognizable now. Like from the Bush.
It's a new party compared to compared to the Bush. Bush,
it's a completely different party. Because
it's much more personalist.
Yeah.
It's much more personal.
But if you look at Democrats, I mean, Clinton is not that different from Biden, right? It's the same people, it's the same system, it's just the same type of people in the power.
Yeah. And I saw him. Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember when I was 16 and getting excited about Bernie. You know, I couldn't vote at the time, but Bernie felt like some real change. And it's funny here because in Germany, he'd probably be like a social democrat, probably an SPD member. Which tells you something about American political discourse and our spectrum. So, yeah, I mean, you know, listen, I believe in voting. I do vote. I mean, I'm going to go on.
Of course, I mean.
But it's.
I mean, I believe more like my whole perspective on elections. It's like you have to go. You can't really have democracy on a large scale. I think the democracy.
Yeah, with a country as large as the United States, you need a republic.
Like, I mean, I would say any large scale like leads to. It's just not a genuine democracy because like you can. I mean, it is kind of like empire, right? Because like, why would someone else? If you live in this city, right, and you have your problems, right, you have like a public transport problem and you want to go and solve it, right, you can only do it obviously on the level of the city. Like, you don't need the government to solve this problem. I mean, this is my thinking about governance. It's like the smaller you go, the more democratic you get.
Yeah, it's much easier. Yeah, in terms of, you know, we think about the Greek ideal, direct participation.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily direct. I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but the more kind of you go and solve the problem and, you know, you have a problem, right? And you go as an expert and say, you know, I create in this local parliament the party of solving this problem, like public transport in Berlin. I really want to do it. If you vote for me, I'm going to solve this problem. And, you know, you go, if they vote for you, you solve the problem, you probably go back or something like this. It's like, of course, I believe in democracy like this, but in a system where you vote, even, for example, now, man, I cannot vote for... I mean, I have so many different kind of like perspectives, right? I cannot say that I can go and vote for this party because it accumulates so many different views. I don't share them, but I have to go and vote this particular.
Like, yeah, scenario. I think, you know, it comes a point in time where if we're talking about electoral democracy, you have to pick one set of actors over another. Mm. Sometimes politics is picking the most comfortable grave, you know? And if you want to be a true revolutionary, though, you can step outside that.
Yeah.
And I respect that depending on where you're coming from. But if we're going to play this democratic game.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, that's how I felt as someone who voted for Kamala.
Yeah.
I had a lot of serious issues with Kamala in terms of she wouldn't even discuss in terms of understanding just how urgent this housing crisis is.
Yeah.
The structural racism in our country.
Yeah.
And how, you know, if you're poor and black or poor and brown, you're way more likely to go to a worse school and less access to post-higher education, you know, college and so on. Yeah. I mean, this is a story all over America. You see it. That was even part of her discussion. And then she moved to the right near the end of immigration. Like, I got some problems. And then, you know, Israel and Palestine, she was giving some soft rhetoric like it was a natural disaster and not the product of a state action. Yeah. But with that being said, easy decision over Trump. You know, easy decision. Yeah, understanding that she's closer to the status quo than Trump is, but not all change is good, unfortunately. So we'll see what happens. Because the thing is, you know, we're only what, about a little over a month into the Trump's presidency.
Brought a lot of excitement. To be honest.
Yeah, a lot of theater. So
it's just the beginning. Yeah. With everything, with Russia, with Ukraine, and with domestic politics as well, you know, obviously.
Yeah, Doge going through everything, all these executive orders.
How it will develop, I mean, we'll have to see, I guess.
Yeah,
so should we just end it
on
this point? Well, thanks for being here.
Of course, man, I always enjoy it.
Yeah, let's talk another time.
For sure.